In Israel, a big turning point. Lawmakers there vote to weaken the independence of the courts, a blow to the long simmering protest movement.
We've been in the streets 7 months hoping that we would not come to this day.
I'm Carol Hills. Also ahead, Europe looks to West Africa for new energy. Some fishermen in Senegal says offshore drilling is destroying them. We are fishermen and we no longer have access to the sea, says this man. Plus, wildfires in Greece are forcing all hands on deck.
People have been opening their houses for tourists and for everyone that's been affected by the fires. Local schools have opened for people to sleep. Everyone is helping.
Including that tour boat operator delivering people out of harm's way. That's all ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Israel's parliament took a big step forward today, voting to limit judicial power. The proposal has deeply divided Israelis for months. The measure dramatically weakens the Supreme Court's independence and greatly strengthens Israel's parliament, the Knesset. Protesters again flooded the streets today, blocking Begin Highway. Israel's largest labor union is considering calling for a national strike. Thousands of reservists are also saying they won't show up for duty. Guy Poran is a former Air Force pilot and an author of the letter stating that pilots will no longer volunteer to serve. We reached him in Tel Aviv. Guy, so what exactly changed with today's vote? Bring us up to speed.
Okay, well, the law that passed today is relatively small, but we see it as the first slice in what we call the salami, which means that behind it, there is a group of other legislation which, as you said, limit the Supreme Court's power and independence.
And what did this measure change today? What did this have to do with in terms of the Supreme Court?
Even if the government takes an unreasonable decision in nominating somebody or firing somebody or doing any kind of law which is unreasonable, up until now, the Supreme Court had the right, on the basis of unreasonableness, to cancel that law. The law that passed today says that the Supreme Court is no longer able to do that.
What was your reaction to today's vote? How are you feeling today?
Well, I was in Jerusalem when the voting happened, and the feeling of the people there, a lot of people were crying. I mean, we've been in the streets 7 months every week, hoping we would not come to this day.
Now, what is this so-called refusal letter that you were involved in, and how did it come together?
We're close to 1,500 ex-Israeli Air Force pilots. We're not active anymore right now, but we've been serving many, many years. A lot of my people are base commanders, squadron commanders, very leading people. Now, the letter that was signed a few days ago and basically announced by several hundreds active Israeli reserve pilots said that if that legislation passed, we're no longer going to continue to volunteer. Voluntary, because the reserve duties of pilots is voluntary. They're not obliged to do that. My group of 1,700 supported the decision and the announcement of those active Air Force pilots.
And so practically speaking, that means that if you were called up for duty, you would refuse to serve.
Because they need to be permanently trained. Every week or 10 days, the reservist pilot goes to the squadron, and for that day, he's like a regular army, a regular Air Force. Now, those pilots that decided to stop their service are just going to announce, they have announced to their squadron commander, to the Air Force, we are no longer going to volunteer. That means take us off your lists. They are volunteers. They're not obliged to go to continue to volunteer. So they basically said, we're not volunteering anymore. And therefore, the Air Force cannot call them anymore.
So can you tell me the significance of what it means that so many people, soldiers, intelligence officers, and pilots, have taken this step?
Most of the Air Force squadrons are based largely on those reservists. So that if so many pilots stop their reserve duties, those squadrons are, I wouldn't say totally paralyzed, but they are not functioning the way they do. In other words, it's a major weakening of the power of the Air Force.
So if there were a national security crisis in Israel soon, based on the numbers of protesting pilots, what could happen?
This country has been dealing with security situations since it was born. Right now, the conflicts which are in the north, the Hezbollah, and in the south, the Hamas in Gaza, are not the kind of conflicts, border conflicts, that you need the full capacity of the Air Force to deal with or the full capacity of the other parts of the army. There is no issue of the security of Israel on the borders being jeopardized in any way by the steps of the reservists. When you're looking more midterm and longer term, the effect of the weakening of the Air Force and other elite units is definitely significant.
Guy Poron is a former Air Force reserve pilot and one of the authors of the so-called refusal letter in which Israeli Air Force reservists said they will not show up for duty if asked. That's in response to the government's plan to overhaul the judiciary. Guy, thank you.
Thank you very much, Carol.
The results are in from Spain's national elections on Sunday. The winner? It's not yet clear. But one thing is, Spanish voters roundly rejected Spain's far-right Vox Party. Vox had hoped to play kingmaker in coalition with the conservative Popular Party. Instead, the ruling socialists have a chance to form a broad coalition to continue in power. As the World's Jerry Haddon reports from Barcelona, that won't be easy.
The future of Spain's government is anyone's guess. Last night, in the midst of the uncertainty, the candidates filled in the blanks with their own wishes.
Me siento muy orgulloso. Hemos conseguido 8 millones.
Take conservative Popular Party leader Alberto Feijó. He told his supporters after polls closed what was technically true, that he'd won, with around 39% of the total vote. I'm proud, he said, that 8 million Spaniards voted for us, up from 5 million in the last elections.
Muchas gracias.
Prime Minister, chanted the crowd. Prime Minister.
Me hago cargo de iniciar el diálogo para formar gobierno.
Enjoying the moment, Feijó said he would demand that his closest rival, Socialist Prime Minister Pedro Sánchez, let him rule, even though he didn't get a majority of votes. I got the most votes, he said, so I earned that right.
El bloque involucionista de retroceso.
Except that across town, Sánchez was too busy having his own party. He told his followers that they'd vanquished a right-wing coalition bent on undoing years of social progress on issues like gender equality and abortion rights. Thing is, though, Sánchez doesn't have it easy either. To clear the 50% hurdle to govern, the socialists need the backing of a handful of small parties that don't exactly share their vision. Two of those parties are from Catalonia in Spain's northeast. Both campaigned on seceding from Spain.
Nosaltres no farem president a Pedro Sánchez a cambio de nada.
Miriam Nogueras of the Junts, or Together for Catalonia party, said she wouldn't give her support to Sánchez for free. What matters to us is Catalonia, she said, not the governability of Spain.
Catalunya o Vox.
The other independence-minded party, Esquerra Republicana, went straight to the point. Sánchez, Gabriel Rufián told his supporters, must side with either Catalonia or Vox. Vox, the extreme right party, was Spain's third largest. It hoped to make history by entering power with Feijó's Popular Party, but it got trounced.
Veo muchas celebraciones en las sedes de los otros partidos. Parece que han ganado todos.
Its president, Santiago Abascal, started his concession speech in surprisingly honest fashion. I see all the other parties are throwing bashes tonight, he said. It appears they've all won. But then he too spun his own unique narrative.
Hemos estado toda la campaña alertando del peligro de unas encuestas.
Our enemies manipulated the polls, he said, to give the impression we were in the lead. That left our voters overconfident while mobilizing the left. Also, he added, the media demonized us. It was classic Vox, which has done best when convincing followers it's under siege. Vox dropped from 52 seats in parliament to 33, making any right-wing coalition impossible. On the left, if Sánchez can't reconcile his national agenda with that of the Catalan parties, Spaniards will find themselves back at the polls come fall. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon in Barcelona.
Fighting in Sudan that started in the capital Khartoum has now gone on for 100 days. Since mid-April, hundreds of Sudanese people have died. Some 3 million have fled their homes. And attempts at international mediation have repeatedly failed. The World's Africa correspondent, Halima Gikandi, has been following the story. She's on the line with me now from Nairobi, Kenya. Remind us, Halima, who's fighting here again and what do they want?
Well, on one side is the Sudanese Armed Forces, and that is the national legitimate force for the country that has a long history. And then on the other side is the Rapid Support Forces, which is functionally a paramilitary group that came out of the massacres in Darfur and has since become a very well-equipped and well-financed armed force. Now, both have worked together in recent years, different times undermining the transitional civilian government that arose after the ousting of Omar al-Bashir. They both participated in the coup in 2021 that ended that civilian government. But over time, there have always been these tensions and power struggles between the two, which finally boiled over into a full-blown armed conflict in April.
Halima, why has this conflict turned out to be so difficult to end?
Well, I think as one diplomat told me, both sides seriously think that they can win and that there is a win to be had. I mean, the RSF have been able to fight off the national forces, which says a lot. At the same time, both have business interests and have money and different ways have looted the nation's resources. And that's also enabled them to fund themselves and finance themselves. And that's actually one of the reasons why the UK recently sanctioned many businesses related to both forces. Also in areas like Khartoum, the RSF is willing to hide its fighters into civilian homes and hospitals and other civilian infrastructure, which makes it hard for the national army to get to them without risking huge civilian casualties. And they also steal from residents by looting cars, looting food, occupying homes. And that happened to Sakina Mohammed Tawfiq from Khartoum.
They stole everything in the house. And every house in the neighborhood, they stole it, and the cars in it.
Sakina has since fled Khartoum to her family home in eastern Sudan.
What is the humanitarian situation like in the country at this point?
Well, it's getting worse by the day. Many people have fled to neighboring countries or their ancestral homes, and life is difficult there because food is hard to find. Things are expensive. People can't even get fuel for their cars sometimes to escape. And in different areas of the country, there are reports of hunger and there are warnings that hunger could become a real concern nationwide soon if humanitarian organizations aren't able to access these areas. At the same time, it's hard for humanitarian workers. I mean, many aid workers have been killed while doing their work. So it's an incredibly bleak situation. We don't have a final set of numbers about civilian casualties so far, but in places like Darfur, there have been reports of mass graves, reports of widespread sexual violence. So across the country right now, it's a bad situation, and people are warning that it can only get worse if fighting continues.
Finally, Halima, Sudan is a country, and you've done reporting about this, that not very long ago seemed to be on a different trajectory. There was a lot of hope about the future of the country. What do you hear from Sudanese people about that now?
One word that I hear from many Sudanese is depression. People feel depressed because, as you said, a couple years ago, Sudan was on a different path. In 2019, the long-standing dictator Omar al-Bashir was ousted. A civilian transitional government came into power. I interviewed countless Sudanese on the ground who were just optimistic about their future. In fact, when I look back at my old notes, I saw that July 2023, that's this month, is when many people expected and hope there would be democratic elections. So I think about all of the people who were optimistic about this new Sudan, and now they're fleeing their homes, they're going hungry, they're losing their loved ones. And Sakina, the resident I spoke with, here's what she said.
Frustrated and hopeless. Very sad. We don't know how it's going to end, but we are sure it's not going to end soon.
Unfortunately, most people I speak with in Sudan feel the same way. They feel sad, they feel depressed, and they also do not expect this conflict to end anytime soon.
Halima Gikandi is the World's Africa correspondent. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Carol.
Just ahead, a tour boat operator describes rescuing people from Greek beaches as wildfires rage on the island of Rhodes. This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Greece continues to battle wildfires at opposite ends of the country. More than 425 wildfires have burned across Greece in the past week, forcing the evacuation of thousands of residents and tourists. The fires have prompted the Prime Minister of Greece, Kyriakos Mitsotakis, to declare, "We are at war." Lieutenant Fire Colonel Yannis Artopios is a spokesperson for the Hellenic Fire Service in Athens. We asked him this morning about the fires on the island of Rhodes.
We are facing very difficult climate conditions, so we have to remember that the 14 last days we have extreme conditions. This made the whole situation there a difficult one.
At this point, is it just Greek firefighters who are working to put out these fires, or are other firefighters from different countries coming to help?
Since the incident broke up in the island of Rhodes, Greece has asked the international help. Right after July 17th, on Monday, we have colleagues, firefighters from France, Turkey, from Israel, from Jordan, from Slovakia. All of these colleagues have come to help, to assist.
I ask because in the past we've heard Greeks say their government is not doing enough to fight fires or prevent fires. Do you think you have enough capacity to deal with the kinds of fires Greece is seeing now?
Well, I think it's not a matter of capacity. I think it's a matter of how hard, how severe is the incident. For example, as we can see around our planet, you can see many wildfires, many gigafires, not only mega, but gigafires in Canada, in Alberta, Canada. It's not a matter of capacity only. It's a matter of how severe, how furious.
Now, the two Greek islands that have been the most impacted, Corfu and Rhodes, they're on opposite ends of Greece. How logistically challenging has that been for the fire service?
Well, as a matter of fact, we have a lot of firemen there in Corfu and in island of Rhodes. But of course, as you can understand, because of the fact that these places are islands, we had to carry a lot of fire vehicles and firemen so far in island of Rhodes, operate there more than 290 firefighters with more than 55 fire trucks. And we had there today more than 15 airplanes and helicopters, and also another 80 firefighters with 25 fire trucks there. But as we say, first of all, we care about human life. Secondly, for the belongings, for the houses, for the touristic section, and of course for the forests. But above all, we have to take seriously under control that human life is above all.
Yannis, have you ever seen a fire season like this?
To be quite honest, yeah, we had seasons like this. In 2009, we had a serious fire incidents. In 2007, we had fire incidents. But what we haven't seen so far is how dramatically the climate has been changed. For example, we never had 15 consecutive days with this kind of climate conditions.
Yannis Artopios is a spokesperson for the Hellenic Fire Service. He's been speaking to us from Athens. Yannis, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Let's focus on the island of Rhodes, where 19,000 people have been evacuated. Many are tourists. Kostas Metulare works for a tour boat company, and he's been using his boat to evacuate people from the beaches of Rhodes. When we spoke this morning, we started by asking Metulare how his family is doing. They all work in tourism.
Luckily, my family is okay, and most of the people here are okay. The situation is not great, but in Pefkos, we're all safe at the moment. The nearest fire in Pefkos is about 10 miles from us at the moment.
So you're 10 miles from the nearest fire. Now, we've heard reports of hotels and homes being forced to evacuate on roads. What kind of damage have you seen?
The damage is massive. It's massive. You couldn't make it up. And there's so many trees have been burned. Animals were killed. People left their houses. People lost their houses. They lost their jobs. It's heartbreaking, you know? I don't know where we go from here.
Now, I know your business caters to tourists. When did you start using your boats to evacuate people?
So it started on Saturday. We went down for work normally, as we always do on Saturday. Things seemed to be better with the fire at the time, but then the wind got so much stronger, and we had a phone call from the local coast guards. Basically, every company that had boats was asked to go down there. Obviously, we agreed. We went straight down. Our crew done a great job, and not just us, but everybody that was there. And, you know, I want to think that everybody will have done the same.
How many people have you evacuated, and where are you taking them?
on that day. You know, there were so many boats there. I think ourselves must have taken about at least 300-400 people.
Wow.
So we started taking them from a place called Qatari into another one, which is very near Pefkos, actually. And then a few hours later, the bigger boats came. So we had to take people from the coast and take them to the bigger boats so they can go all the way to Rhodes Town.
And where are people finding shelter once they're evacuated?
People have been opening their houses for tourists and for everyone that's been affected by the fires. Local schools have opened for people to sleep, and literally everything is being used. Everyone is helping, and that's the only good thing.
How has the government's response been so far?
No, this is a good question, because I've been watching the local news in Greece, and they seem to think that the government has done a great job. That hasn't been the case. That has not been the case at all. The fire started a whole week ago, so the fire has been going on for a week. We knew, we could see it. It was only the local fire department that was working for it, and obviously the volunteers as well. But we didn't get any help from the mainland Greece until Saturday. So that's literally 3 days, almost 4 days after the fire actually started. So they underestimated it, completely underestimated it all.
Are you seeing more government services arriving in the form of fire and emergency people?
We are now, but now it seems to be a little too late for everyone. We have obviously planes flying now, but our government, they wasted so much time, valuable time as well.
How important is tourism to the local economy of Rhodes?
That's the biggest source of income. You know, everyone I know, that's how they all make a living, with tourism, literally everyone.
It's incredible. This has been going on for 7 days. I mean, is there any sign these fires will end soon, or are they continuing to spread?
We've been thinking every morning things look better, but then in the afternoon, as the winds pick up, they seem to be getting worse. The fires have moved to the southern part of the island, and there's another fire higher up. It's about another 10 miles from Pefkos. So we have a fire on the southern side of Pefkos, then another one on the northern part of the island. So the fire spreads in about 30 kilometers.
What do you feel like you need the most right now in terms of the town you're in? What's most needed?
So in Pefkos, we need people to be patient and stay calm. We seem to be fine here, but then the rest of the island is in massive need of help. They need to send more planes. We've only seen 3 little planes flying this last few days. So we need help. I don't know what kind of help we can get, but we need any kind of help we can get at the moment. There have been firefighters that have been fighting with the fire for a whole week. It's difficult. How long are they going to be able to fight for? You know? They haven't had much sleep. We've been trying to help them. We've been giving them drinks and food, whatever we can. But there's only so much we can do. We need more help. The Greek government wasted so much time. I want to say that again. They wasted so much time. We will see the fire. We knew the fire could get so much worse. They should have dealt with it then. They didn't. And now we're paying the price for it.
Rhodes is such an historic island. Are you concerned the history there is getting damaged, the cultural history?
It's getting damaged, yeah, but I think people make this place. I know we have a great history as an island, but people are making this place. It's local people who make it so good. And even in these hard times, they've opened their houses for people. And it's a great hospitality for you. That's what makes this place special. We'll make this place good. We'll make it like it was again.
We've been speaking to Kostas Metulari. He's a crew member for the company Glass Bottom Boats in the seaside town of Pefkos on the Greek island of Rhodes. Kostas, thank you for taking the time to speak with us, and stay safe.
Thank you for listening to me.
More stories from around the globe are still coming your way this hour. You're listening to The World. In Boston, millions of tourists walk the iconic Freedom Trail, a historic tour of the Revolutionary War. What's largely left out? The links to slavery.
And it's necessary to remember that the only reason the revolution was able to thrive was because it was funded by an economic system totally supported by enslavement.
Rethinking history, ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. The war in Ukraine has forced European countries to look for new energy sources, including West Africa. Senegal and Mauritania are right next to each other on the Atlantic coast. They've partnered with global corporations to capitalize on recent discoveries of natural gas. But many locals are wondering how much they will actually benefit from their country's resources. The World's Tibisa Isaya reports from Saint Louis, Senegal.
It's one of the largest discoveries of natural gas in the last 2 decades. Senegal and Mauritania found world-class deposits of this precious commodity off the Atlantic shore, and a plan to export that gas abroad is bringing hope for the economies of the two countries.
I want us to profit from the gas, because as soon as we start extracting, I expect the electricity prices, fuel, even food prices will drop and become affordable for us.
That's Aguibo Ba from Senegal's National Institute of Oil and Gas speaking to a TV station. The joint project with Senegal and Mauritania involves two energy giants, BP and Kosmos Energy. The first phase of the project is almost finished, and that means it could start producing and exporting liquefied natural gas as soon as this fall. Germany and Poland have already signed deals with Senegal's government. Experts say natural gas won't transform Senegal into a rich country, but it could bring economic growth. William Davis is with the Natural Resource Governance Institute in the United Kingdom.
It might help the government to achieve universal access to electricity by 2025, and so an individual person might get access to electricity that they never had before.
But many locals are skeptical about any promises of a more prosperous future thanks to natural gas. Outside the coastal city of Saint-Louis in northern Senegal, fishermen are unloading their daily catch. From the outdoor market here, you can see a natural gas rig out in the ocean. Fishermen tell me they passed right by the rig on their way out to sea. Baba Diane, speaking through an interpreter, says this natural gas project has only brought unemployment and poverty to this fishing village.
We used to have a lot of fish at sea, and now we don't have that. And that's our number one problem. We are fishermen and we don't have access to the sea.
Badian says to make way for the drilling of natural gas, access for fishermen is limited. And the pirogues, or the boats used for fishing here, are not allowed to go into certain areas.
And the marines pass by every day, but you're not allowed to get anywhere nearby. And if you do, you will be attacked. Very recently, a pirogue attempted to get nearby, and the marines just cut the pirogue in half. They just hit it.
Boun Dauda Soumaré is with the Regional Development Agency of Saint-Louis. He conceded that the natural gas project does have downsides for local fishing communities. Soumaré says the authorities have to think about gas leaks in the area that can affect the fish population. But he says people need to be patient as jobs and other benefits from the gas deal will materialize in the future. Baba Diane, the local fisherman, tells me he doesn't trust the government.
Because we have the feeling that given all the parties involved, Senegal will not have much on its own. And if there is, it may be taken for other purposes.
This lack of trust is common in many African countries, as Will Davis explains.
Transparency and accountability is a key factor in making sure that the revenues are used well for the benefit of the population rather than the political priorities of the government of the day or even the personal priorities of politicians who are in power.
The city of Saint-Louis is also grappling with sea level rise, which has already displaced thousands of people. Fishermen tell me that the natural gas project, combined with the impact of climate change, might be the end of their way of life. Officials with the two gas companies involved with the project turned down interview requests for this story. For the world, I'm Tivisa Izea, Saint-Louis, Senegal.
In Ecuador yesterday, the killing of a mayor is putting a spotlight on the growing problems of violence. The mayor of Manta, Agustin Triago, was making a neighborhood visit when he was gunned down. Sebastian Hurtado has been following the story and the growing problem of violence and political instability in Ecuador. He's the president of Profitas, a political risk consultancy firm in Ecuador's capital, Quito. Sebastian, what do we know about the shooting yesterday? What happened?
Mayor in Triago was doing local visits with some of his aides and followers, and he was shot in the middle of the day by gunmen, most likely hires for his killing. And he was taken to a hospital and he didn't survive, and I think he was shot multiple times.
Manta, it's a city of close to 200,000 people. Do we know why the mayor was targeted?
You know, the situation in the coast of Ecuador has been deteriorating for a number of years now, basically due to the influence of criminal organizations related to drug trade. that have begun infiltrating Ecuadorian coasts.
And you mentioned the coastal region. Manta is on the Pacific coast, north of Guayaquil, the largest city in Ecuador. Some observers, and also you, have suggested this was a hit job by organized crime. I mean, how common are political murders in Ecuador?
In the last election cycle, we had local elections back in February. At least two politicians running for office were killed. But by far, this is the highest profile killing of a political figure by criminal organizations in Ecuadorian recent history.
How come there's a rise in violence now? What's fueling that in these port cities?
The thing is that we see market conditions changing. You know, Ecuador has become a major exporter of drugs to Europe, where cocaine is more expensive than it is in the U.S. So basically, all these international criminal organizations from Colombia and Mexico and some criminal organizations from Europe have basically built this new route to move drugs from Colombia through the Ecuadorian coasts and through the Ecuadorian ports. And Manta is a major Ecuadorian port.
But why would murdering the mayor of this city, what advantage would that give these drug gangs?
There's still confusing information regarding this. But, you know, during the local election campaign early this year, there were accusations directly towards this mayor of potentially being involved with criminal organizations. And that's public information. It is a very contentious issue because a mayor was killed. It has been shocking. So I don't think many people will like to hear that he had some potential connections with criminal organizations. But that could be the reason or one of the reasons behind this killing.
A number of months ago, we read about Ecuador's prisons being overrun by gangs, a lot of violence. Is the violence in the prisons related to the violence in the coastal cities, meaning possibly linked to drug cartels?
Yeah, for sure. Prisons in Ecuador have become actually headquarters for many criminal organizations to run their businesses. And you have different criminal organizations represented within the prisons. And basically what happens is that from time to time, they get into a confrontation, and that happens inside of the prisons and outside of the prisons.
How big of an issue is this becoming for Ecuadorian voters? I mean, could it affect those who are running for legislature next month? I mean, is it going to show up in elections?
You know, crime is for some time now the top voter concern, and that is reflected in most polls. And I think what happened over the weekend will bring more focus on that. And I think some candidates will benefit from having a better public profile in terms of their crime-fighting credentials. And it will not benefit other candidates that might look weak or just not having the right capacity to deal with this kind of violence. So it's going to be a defining feature of this election for sure.
Sebastian Hurtado is president of Profitas in Quito, Ecuador. He's been speaking about the growing problem of violence in Ecuador. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
In Russia, speaking out against the war in Ukraine can land you in jail, possibly for years. So thousands of Russians who oppose the conflict have fled for safety to nearby countries. But as Levi Bridges reports, even once they've left the country, Russian dissidents aren't exactly safe.
After Russia invaded Ukraine, Yevgenia Baltatareva, a journalist and activist in Siberia, started posting online about her opposition to the war. Just a week later, more than a dozen police officers showed up at Baltatareva's apartment with a search warrant.
I knew that something bad is going to happen. Repressions are coming because of this war.
Police eventually opened a criminal case against Baltatareva for spreading fake news about the war. But by then, she had already crossed the border to nearby Kazakhstan.
Kazakhstan, it was quite good. I found a job. I found friends. My relatives could visit me here.
But then she started having problems. Kazakh authorities detained Baltatareva to extradite her to Russia. They eventually let her free, but she's not allowed to leave the country. And her work permit wasn't renewed. There's always the threat of getting deported to Russia.
this is the most dangerous situation I've ever been in my life, because I am accused to being in jail for up to 15 years, and I'm not a criminal, I'm just a journalist.
Recently, Baltatarova tried to apply for asylum in Kazakhstan, but officials refused to accept her application. In a video she took, Baltatarova asks Kazakh officials to explain why. A woman just slams the door in her face. They eventually did accept Baltatarova's application, but that doesn't exactly give her peace of mind. Recently, Kazakhstan deported a Russian officer who also applied for asylum. He's serving more than 6 years in jail for avoiding military service. Harboring anti-war Russians has become a liability for former Soviet countries that border Russia. Many people in countries like Kazakhstan strongly support Ukraine, but their governments still maintain close economic and security ties with Russia, so they don't want to appear too friendly to dissidents. Filmmakers from Al Jazeera recently captured some pretty incredible footage of Russians gathering on the streets in Almaty, Kazakhstan, to show their support for Ukraine. And you can sense just how uneasy some people are doing this in public. One man steps up before the crowd to read a passage of a Ukrainian poet. Doesn't seem like anything too radical, but another Russian immediately runs up and stops him. We need to keep a very low profile here, a woman tells him, or someone might get deported. Countries in the region are taking different approaches to dealing with Russian migrants. Katya Arenina is an investigative journalist from Russia who moved to Georgia in the South Caucasus before the war. She says the last time she flew to Georgia, customs officials in the airport took her aside. She says they eventually told her she wasn't allowed to enter the country, even though she'd never committed a crime there. They didn't give her a reason, but Arenina says actually she wasn't surprised. Because, she says, in the couple of weeks before this went down, five other Russians with similar backgrounds were also turned away at the Georgian border. Arenina lives in Lithuania now. But even Russians who make it to the EU, in countries that are firmly out of Russia's orbit, still don't exactly feel welcome. I talked to Russians in the EU who said landlords often don't want to rent to them, and they can't open bank accounts because of sanctions. Anti-Russian sentiment is tearing up some people's lives.
For me, like personally, this is the hardest time in my life.
Nikolai moved to Estonia before the war to launch a startup. He asked us not to use his last name out of concern for his safety. But he says investors are severing ties with companies founded by Russians like him.
So it looks like the startup is dead.
He's having trouble renewing his residency permit because Estonia has made the process far more difficult for Russian citizens.
I think they have doubts that I am a Russian spy. And that's the excuse they're using around the Europe to just reject a visa or residence permit. You are a national threat, that's it.
Russians like Nikolai are just hoping they won't be deported back to Russia, where he could go to jail for opposing the war or get drafted to fight in Ukraine. Yevgenia Baltatarova, the journalist in Kazakhstan, is also waiting to renew her expired immigration documents.
You have to face every day danger of being deported, extradited. You have that worries every time because we are not accepted as victims of this war.
For people like Baltatarova, sometimes it feels like there's nowhere left to run. For The World, I'm Levi Bridges.
Now a quick update on the status of Private Travis King. He's the U.S. soldier who ran across a militarized border into North Korea last week. Today, the UN group that organizes international response to conflicts on the Korean Peninsula said it has started a conversation with North Korea about King's whereabouts. But that was pretty much all the UN command could say in the press conference in Seoul today. Among the things it would not say, how North Korea has responded, and what U.S. and U.N. authorities know about King's condition. Deputy Commander Andrew Harrison cautioned reporters by saying, quote, "None of us know where this is going to end." Harrison added, I am in life an optimist, and I remain optimistic. But again, I will leave it at that. In Boston, a 2.5-mile red line, embedded bricks in the ground in a line of red paint, brings tourists to the historic spots in America's war for independence. It's called the Freedom Trail. It takes you past Paul Revere's house, the site of the Boston Massacre, and the old State House, to name a few. More than 4 million people walk it each year. But what most people don't know is that the historic sites also have a direct connection to the international slave trade. That was the discovery of a joint investigation by GBH and a team of Boston University students. Paul Singer of the GBH News Center for Investigative Reporting is here to explain these international ties. Paul, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me, Carol.
Now, how did this project take shape?
Well, one of the sites on the trail last fall began to reveal new curriculum to explain their own roots in the slave trade. And we did a story about that. And, you know, the finding was essentially that everybody who had funded the original construction of the church had some connection to this international slave trade, and that's where the money came from. So we decided to ask, well, what about the other sites on the Freedom Trail? And the fact of the matter is that if this was the economy of Boston at the time, then all the other sites on the Freedom Trail should have probably similar links to the slave trade.
So you, along with these Boston University students, you worked hard uncovering a lot of information that was missing about the Freedom Trail's historical sites and the enslaved people who helped make Boston's revolution possible. Let's hear your report.
The red line in the ground behind us, that is the actual Freedom Trail.
On a June morning, like every morning, a crowd of a few dozen people gathered on Boston Common for a tour of the Freedom Trail, led by a guide wearing a tri-cornered hat. The red brick trail leads visitors to churches, landmarks, and the graves of historic figures like John Hancock or John Winthrop, the first governor of Massachusetts. But what these tours generally don't tell visitors is that every single one of the sites has some deep link to slavery.
If you're familiar with the history of colonial Boston, the idea of a Freedom Trail itself might ring a little bit ironic.
That's Cassandra Dumay, a journalism student at Boston University, standing in the King's Chapel burying ground. Dumay and her classmates this spring helped GBH News investigate a new map we are calling the Enslavement History of the Freedom Trail. What they realized was that the entire economy of colonial Boston was propped up by enslaved labor. Many households held slaves, including those of John Hancock and John Winthrop. Even the iconic warship, the USS Constitution, was built with wood harvested by enslaved workers in Georgia. For several months, the students searched probate records, worked with archivists, and quizzed city officials to piece together information on the slavery connections of each site, information that had long been ignored. For example, here's how our guide described the 1770 Boston Massacre.
The first man killed that night was a free black sailor, a man named Crispus Attucks.
What the guide did not mention was that Attucks was the son of an enslaved man and a Native American woman. In 1750, when he escaped to become a sailor, he was pursued as a runaway slave. Lamurchie Fraser is former director of education for the Museum of African American History. She says it's ironic that the Freedom Trail generally fails to tell the story of blacks and Native Americans because they were also involved in a struggle for their liberty.
If you leave out that expanded narrative of black and indigenous people here, you have really done a woeful job of delivering history.
Fraser also points out that the story of enslavement is not just about blacks being victims. As white Bostonians were fighting to throw off British rule, black Bostonians were educating themselves, building wealth, and campaigning for their freedom.
No, this is strategized, networked, organized movement to secure their voices, their land, their property.
Several sites along the Freedom Trail have begun telling this more complicated version of colonial history. For example, King's Chapel has approved a massive new memorial to recognize the 219 enslaved people who were part of the church's history. The city is trying to lead the way with a new exhibit inside Faneuil Hall that documents more than 1,300 people who were enslaved here. But a walk along the Freedom Trail still shows they have a long way to go to elevate the stories of all Boston's ancestors.
GBH's Paul Singer reporting there, and he's here with me in the studio. Paul, I want to go back in time with regards to the Hancock family. You reported that enslaved people are linked to what was being imported from the Caribbean and Portugal to the American colonies. Explain that connection between Boston and those two areas.
Right. It's important to remember that all of the commerce, the international commerce that was going on, remember at this point, Boston is a big shipping port. It all connected to the slave trade in one way or another, even if they weren't shipping people. So the Hancock family, for instance, is selling Madeira wine coming from Madeira in Portugal. Well, the wine itself is being transported in casks that were reused sugar casks that had been assembled by enslaved people in the Caribbean. So again, the cask goes from the Caribbean to Portugal to be made into a wine cask. The wine cask gets on the boat and comes here. Was there an enslaved person on the boat? No. Was the product of enslavement on the boat? Absolutely.
Boston's Freedom Trail, it attracts millions of people from all over the world. Will these revelations impact tourists or taint Boston's legacy, do you think?
You know, it's a really important question. A lot of the sites are beginning to rethink how they tell their stories. But I will also tell you that, and it saddens me really, that a number of tour guides I've spoken to have said that people get aggravated when they raise slavery. People don't come to hear that in some cases. They want to just be told about the hero on the horse with the gun. And it is a challenge for America to really grapple with these things in a way that both recognizes that this was a remarkable experiment in revolution and freedom, but on the other hand, that it has this baggage that comes with it.
Now, Massachusetts was the first state to effectively abolish slavery. They did that in 1783. Why is it important to illustrate how the Commonwealth benefited from the international slave trade until that point?
Well, if you walk the Freedom Trail, you get the history that is being told of what one of my sources referred to as a white man on a horse with a gun. And the fact of the matter is that the history of Boston and the history of the American colonies is far more complicated than that. We have always thought of ourselves here in Massachusetts as, oh, we're the good guys, the South, that's where the slavery was. But the fact of the matter was, Massachusetts was the first state to actually establish slavery as a legal code in 1641. And it's necessary to remember that the only reason the Revolution was able to thrive was because it was funded by an economic system totally supported by enslavement.
Paul Singer is from the GBH News Center for Investigative Reporting. Thank you, Paul.
Thanks for having me, Carol. Appreciate it.
The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Billa Harris studio at GBH in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carol Hills. Thank you for listening.
From PRX.